May it please the court. I'm Barry Grossman, one of the attorneys for the defendant appellant, Sarah Cullen. On May 11, 2014, Sarah Cullen was found guilty by a jury of one count of child abuse resulting in a death. She was sentenced to not less than 7 years and no more than life. She did have 413 days of credit. My argument today really kind of focuses on evidence that was allowed in a case involving the death of a child, which understandably is extremely emotional. The trial itself was long. So I believe in my arguments, in my brief, really focus on the prejudice that is danger in these kind of cases. During the trial as well as sentencing, the district court erred in denying Ms. Cullen's motion for a mistrial and overruled several different objections with regard to evidence being brought in. My argument focuses on roughly four different items, but again, most of it involves prejudice that's heightened by these kind of cases. With the first one, during the trial proceedings, the state offered evidence in the form of text messages and photographs to show prior bad acts of Sarah Cullen, in spite of a 404 ruling on a hearing that happened before trial that disallowed prior bad wrongful acts.
Well, to be clear, Mr. Grossman, the subject of the 404 hearing is not the same evidence that you're complaining about now, right?
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. However, I believe, Your Honor, that the 404 itself deals with prior bad acts. There were a variety of prior bad acts that were brought forth at trial. Those prior bad acts involved minor injuries that happened to the child up to 2 months before the actual death of the child.
But let's also sort of clear away the underbrush. The subject of the 404 hearing was not offered or admitted at trial, correct?
It involved, you're right, Your Honor, in some respects, because it was daycare, it was some daycare
prior
incidents.
Daycare. Other children was excluded.
That's
by the
correct.
Trials. Okay, so now we're at trial and we're talking about something the state did not characterize as 404 at any point. They're characterizing it as inextricably intertwined, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that's really the heart of the issue. Is this 404 evidence or is it inextricably intertwined?
And I believe, and I think that's correct in a sense. I remember that in the 404 ruling, the judge said he would take up the type of evidence that was brought in at trial later. But I also, under my argument, am also putting forth this court that it isn't blended. It isn't encased in one another to show what happened. Because I believe, again, the underlying danger here is a prejudice.
Well, help us out. What were the inextricably intertwined acts?
Well, the argument of the state is that there were some injuries that happened to the child while allegedly in the care of our client.
Were these negligent acts, careless acts, reckless acts?
They're alleged to be careless acts, but they were minor injuries to the child. And again, we're talking about a very, very small child. Those acts were explained by the defendant to the parents of the deceased child after each one happened.
So were they admitted because of, did the court determine they were inexplicable?
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
Why did the court allow them in?
Because of the argument that they were closely intertwined with the accident that actually happened to the child. And I think that's why the court let it in.
Were there objections?
There were objections. There were objections throughout this entire trial.
So why weren't they inextricably intertwined?
I believe because, number one, because it dated back 2 months. And I also believe that the incidents themselves were minor enough that were
minor in that they were, at the worst, they were carelessness?
That's exactly right. At the worst, they were carelessness.
Okay. And so your position is they were careless, and so how could they be intertwined because this is an intentional act?
That's part of it. And that was the argument of the state.
Could they also have been the result of intentional acts?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Could they also have been the result of intentional acts?
I don't believe so. I don't believe that they were.
Were they was the crime charged for a period of time within, did these alleged incidences occur within the time period charged in the charging document?
I believe, you know, to be honest with you, Your Honor, I'm not sure whether or not it was included within that. I believe the focus was more on what had happened that actually caused the death of the child. But again, I believe that those prior bad acts that were admitted were extremely prejudicial. And I understand that the 404 hearing dealt with the daycare incidents, but I still believe that the spirit of 404 is to leave these things out if they are going to cause prejudice. And there were a continual, and again, there were a continual amount of prejudice.
Assuming you are correct, that the court erred in allowing these acts in the context of the evidence here, was it a harmless error?
I don't believe it's a harmless error when we're talking about a heightened prejudice. I don't agree with the fact that this is a harmless error, especially in light of other factors that went into the trial that were prejudicial, which leads me to my second argument, which is statements made by the prosecutor in the closing argument. So in retrospect, I don't believe that this was harmless error. I think the only thing I can compare it to is just flames of the fire. And again, this goes to my second part of my argument. At the crucial part of the trial, which was the closing, prosecutor pressed to the jury that, number one, she had seen that Sarah Cullen showed no emotion during the testimony, no emotion during the presentation of photographs, no emotion during autopsy pictures, and she compared Sarah Cullen's demeanor to that of another witness that had been on the stand. These were not evidence. This was perceptions by the prosecutor that were given to a jury that had just sat in a week-long trial involving the death of a child. I think at that point in time, again, it becomes extremely prejudicial to a jury of 12 people that are hearing all the evidence involving the death of the child.
Can a jury take their observations of the defendant sitting in the courtroom? Can they take those observations into consideration?
I don't believe that they can take the observations of the prosecutor into consideration. And I think that's the way that it was handled. Is that, here is what I saw. It's not, you have seen this. I don't believe that was the testimony in the, I don't believe that was the transcript. The way that it was presented was, this is the way I see it. And I think if you look at State versus Dubray, they talk about the factors that is looked at with regard to prosecutorial misconduct for purposes of this kind of thing. Defense counsel did not invite these kind of remarks that were made at the closing. This was a long, extensive, and highly emotional trial.
Is that the list of whether or not misconduct is prejudicial?
That's correct. That's correct. And there wasn't any curative instruction provided by the court with regard to this.
Was there an objection made?
There were objections made. There's an argument with regard to the objection that it was not made timely such that it preserved it for purposes of appeal. But we disagree with that, with the transcript. And we disagree with that based on State versus Watt, because there was an objection made before the statement in its closing. Now, in light of that, I will also point out to the court, and I apologize, I'm actually going to arguments, that the statement was objected to probably should have been objected to a little earlier to try to reduce that amount of prejudice that inflamed the jury, that we believe inflamed the jury. And that's part of the argument with regard to ineffective assistance of counsel. But for purposes of this argument, the misconduct of the prosecutor at a very crucial point in the trial was so prejudicial that it robbed the defendant of a fair trial.
Did the defendant testify?
The defendant did not.
Did not testify.
And as such, the district court erred in not declaring a mistrial in this case.
So you objected to the closing argument, the counsel did, of the prosecutor because the prosecutor's statement of his perception was actually a statement of he was acting as a witness when he made that statement.
That's what we believe, Your Honor.
And
we don't know.
Then you objected. Did you then move for a mistrial or direct the court to, or request the court direct the jury to disregard that argument?
I don't believe not at that time. I think there was an objection made by defense counsel.
That error is properly preserved then by making that objection?
I do. And just to be clear, if Your Honors probably already do know that I was not the defense counsel.
Right.
And that changes.
Your version
things.
It might be better. It's good enough.
I'm sorry.
Might have been better, but it's good enough to preserve.
Exactly. And I'm using the term. I believe in the brief we use the term global. That covered what was required to preserve it for purposes of appeal.
Do you have to move for a mistrial?
I don't think State versus Watt says that. I don't think State versus Watt requires that it be a motion for a mistrial with regard to it. Now,
well, why aren't you then gambling as to the result if you don't ask for a new trial?
Well, I will mention to Your Honors that there was motions for mistrial in this case. It wasn't that it was devoid of that. It really did have motions for mistrials in there. However,
but this wasn't one of the subjects.
Not during that time, no.
Okay.
For purposes of, with regard to the third argument, for purposes of sentencing Sarah Cullen, understandably the court is not limited under its discretion, but it's guided by a lot of different factors that I'm sure Your Honors know by heart. However, with regard to this case, district court failed to take into account many factors. And this is in retrospect by looking at the severity of the sentence. She had a willingness to accept her responsibility under what happened for her actions. She had a willingness to plead to an attempt. Excuse me. She had been pursuing her education, which is one of the factors. Before incarcerated,
What was her age?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't believe I know what her age to be. I believe it was in her 20s.
Under this sentence, she's got to serve at least 35 years.
She does.
Before she's eligible for parole.
That's correct.
Okay.
She has a 6-year-old child. She had a child that she gave birth to while incarcerated. I don't believe, based on the sentencing itself, the excessive sentence, that the district court took that into account.
Did the court consider what was the cause of the death of the infant?
I believe it did.
What was it that caused the child's death?
Head trauma.
How was it? How did it happen?
Well, and that was part of the trial, is how did it actually happen?
Was it based on shaken baby syndrome?
It was, in some respect, yes. There was, and...
Well, you say in some respects.
It was. I'm sorry, Your Honor, it was.
Ophthalmologist wasn't testified that it was shaken baby syndrome.
I apologize.
All right, that's all right.
It was more of an, I believe with regard to this, the injuries that were done by skull fractures and bruises, it was more of an impact type injury, if that helps.
So this child had to come in contact with something else?
Correct.
That would presumably be a solid, hard object?
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, if we go back...
But they also threw in the baby shaken baby syndrome, too, did they?
It could be, with high impact.
Okay.
My concern, however, and again, I'll go back to my original argument, is this was an horrible incident that caused the death of the child, but the prior bad acts that I've mentioned before were very minor that looked to negligence as opposed to, if anything else. I will try to repeat brief, Your Honors, but I also wanted to add, with regard to the excessive sentence, there was no evidence indicating an intent to kill in them. And I don't believe that was taken into account for purposes of the severity of the sentence itself. With regard to the ineffective assistance of counsel, it focused on more of timely objections. But those timely objections, again, in a case involving a child, become extremely important. They become extremely important to be timely. We believe that because of statements that were made by a witness who speculated that the cause of the death, cause of the child's injuries was our client, and closing statement, those objections were not timely. And because of that...
Can we reach this issue here, or do you need an evidentiary hearing on...
I'm sorry, Aaron?
Can we reach ineffective assistance of counsel in this case, or do we need an evidentiary hearing to determine...
I believe it's apparent on the record, and I understand that as part of the law, because this counsel is different than that of the trial court, it has to be apparent from the record, and I believe it is apparent from the record. And again, if for all these reasons, I would ask that the court either reverse the district court's order denying the appellant's motion for mistrial, or that the court reverse the severe sentence.
Thank you very much. Ms. Faust, good morning.
Thank you, support counsel. My name is Stacey Faust, Assistant Attorney General representing the appellee in the state of Nebraska. I want to start by explaining the facts that make this case different from child abuse cases where this court has applied Rule 404 evidence. This case is about 4-month-old Cash Bell, who was physically and developmentally healthy until Sarah Colon came into his life for the short 7-week period that she did. Nearly weekly, while he was in her care, Cash sustained injuries, and they increased in severity until the injuries that resulted in his death. Colon always informed Ashley Bell, who was Cash's mom, about when Cash was sick or sustained a minor injury, but notably that communication stopped when Cash sustained injuries that could not be explained away with the dog or the door did it. And that's why this case is different from other child abuse cases considered by this court on the issue of Rule 404. The frequency and the increased severity of the injuries that occurred while in the defendant's care in such a short period of time.
A question was asked about the charging document.
Yes, the full amount of time that he was in her care was charged, January 1st to February 28th. He actually started caring for him alone on January 7th. It was all within the charging document. And I think that also goes to, I can't say that the bruises and the scratches resulted in the injuries that ultimately caused his death. But I think it goes to support the fact that it is the factual setting of this crime that is charged.
Let me get this straight. Are you arguing that these items were unreported in the diaries or the emails to the mother?
The ultimate ones that caused his death?
No, not the ones that caused his death, but the minor ones that were...
The minor ones, for the most part, were always reported to her. The ones that Colon could explain, like a scratch or a bruise on the face. Oh, the dog did it. A bump on the forehead. Oh, I was carrying him outside and the wind caught the door and hit him in the head. But when we start getting to the broken blood vessel in the eye and the abrasions under the chin that are caused by the metal clasp of his onesie being pushed so hard and under his chin that it causes the abrasions and the 2 skull fractures and the brain injury that occurred in this case and the ones that caused his death.
The ones that didn't cause the death, are you arguing that those are the ones that were inextricably intertwined?
Yes, Your Honor.
So there wasn't any evidence that was allowed under a 404?
Well, the state presented evidence that they thought believed it was 404, but that was as to kids at the previous daycares where the colon had worked, and the court did not allow that in, finding it too prejudicial.
I may have this confused with another case where you had so many. Was there a ruling that they allowed, the court allowed evidence in because of, to show absence of mistake?
No, not in this case.
All right.
As this court is well aware, there is an exception to the limitations of Rule 404, and that is the intrinsic or inextricably intertwined exception, and that is what the state submits as applicable here, not Rule 404.
I beg your pardon, and that was the basis of
yes.
the ruling.
Yeah. I wouldn't say there is really a rule. I mean, that was the state's argument of, hey, this is, we're putting on the previous daycare evidence because we think that's 404. We're not putting in the prior injuries to Cash because we think it's inextricably intertwined, and the court said, okay, we're having the hearing, and it's on the daycare evidence.
Thank you. And then during the trial, were there objections to each one of these incidences?
She received continuing objections.
Okay, so tell me why they were inextricably intertwined.
I think Cash's prior injury certainly established her intent to commit the injuries or resulted in death. It's circumstantial evidence. But I think most importantly is that it provided the jury with the whole story because it was a continuous course of conduct by her that simply it can't be parsed out. The state had every right to present the whole picture to the jury, and part of that picture includes the factual setting that since day two, the Cash was in her care until the 7 weeks later when he died, he was injured frequently, routinely, and the injuries increased in severity until the ones that ultimately resulted in his death. This evidence is not about Colin's character, which ultimately is what 4042 is concerned about. The evidence speaks to the likelihood that Colin intentionally committed the injuries that resulted in Cash's death. In other words, strong circumstantial evidence that she committed this crime. And that's why it's intrinsic and that's why it's not 404.
What do you believe the evidence shows as to cause of death and shaken baby, blunt force trauma, either or both?
The pathologist testified that it was blunt force head trauma. Now we have her testimony, and we also have the radiologist's testimony, and we have Dr. Haney's testimony, who is an expert in child abuse and neglect cases. And the fractures, I think they all agree that the fractures are impact, they're impact style. But they also all agree there is deceleration or acceleration, which is being shaken.
Did they age the fractures?
They did age the fractures. The radiologist said that the fracture to the back of the head, I believe, let's see. The one on the right, the one that went to the right, the base of the skull, was 0 to 7 days within February 28th, which is the date we're ultimately talking about here, because it was still swollen. She couldn't determine the age of the other because it was not swollen, and she also didn't know if maybe that was also because it was committed with less force than the one on the right side. The pathologist testified that they were both 1 week to 14 days within the date of the March 6th autopsy, which would take you back to February 28th, 1 week. She said it was less likely that it was the 14 days, though, because of the brain injury.
So did they occur at different times?
I think there was, they didn't quite, I'd say the radiologist wasn't sure, the pathologist was.
I guess where we're going here in terms of the calendar, are there injuries arguably causing the death that are older than the last 2 weeks, for which these other so-called minor injuries would be relevant?
I guess, yes, all the more reason that it's inextricably intertwined, because we do have the pediatrician testifying that he is developmentally and healthy during all his previous examinations, and he would have been able to feel if there were a fracture. And wasn't. He was healthy. There was nothing wrong with him until he came into Sarah Colin's care.
So let me ask the question again about the two blunt force incidences. Could they have occurred at different times?
The impact, the fractures?
Yes.
I don't believe so, because the pathologist testified that there was a large hematoma on the back of his head, bleeding, that she associated with a fracture on the back of the head. And so if you combine that with the radiologist's testimony about the one on the side to the base of the skull that she places within the February 28th date range, they both do.
Are these subdural or intracranial hematomas?
He had bleeding in and around the entirety of his brain, so both.
So some of it was inside
yes.
the brain?
Yes, he had 90% brain injury, permanently damaged. 90% was deprived of oxygen. The likelihood of recovery was nil. This is not like the court's cases of Kuhner, Chavez, two of this court's previous decisions in child abuse cases that involved Rule 404, because in those cases, there was either no connection between the defendant and the injuries, or occurred only once or twice in a month or over a month prior to the death. This is not the typical battered child syndrome case where we have medical findings that reveal old healed injuries and no one can say for certain who, when, how, or where. We know these things because Colin reported them. We know they occurred while in her care because she said so. Now, admittedly, she may not have admitted the broken blood vessel occurred while in her care, but I think her text on February 15th to Ashley can certainly be read that way, or at least it was on another admission that another injury occurred to him while in her care. And she denied the abrasions under the chin, but that's where her lack of communication is so important, because she did see them on February 25th. She said so in her interview to law enforcement, and she never told Ashley about them when she had previously had this open communication about that kind of information. And it was also only 3 days, again, before the injuries that resulted in his death, and they were still visible to the naked eye on February 28th when he was presented to the ER.
And that failure to communicate goes to consciousness of guilt?
Absolutely. I do want to pitch, just out of an abundance of caution, the state submits that the introduction of the evidence would be harmless if it was error. The evidence was admitted only after Colin's statements to law enforcement were admitted at trial. And during those statements, she attempted to explain Cash's death resulting injuries with prior events that could not have possibly caused them. The dog trampled him before. She hit his head on the door that day. He wiggled out of his swing that day. She fell down the stairs with him. She fell up the stairs with him. She admitted the prior injuries in that interview, and only after the detectives gave her piecemeal information about Cash's injuries, and only after they decided to act like they bought her last story, did she stop making up stories. The jury ultimately would have come to the same guilty verdict. As for prosecutorial misconduct during closing, Collins waived this issue because she never motioned for mistrial during closing. Dubray is obvious on that. You have to motion for a mistrial when you're going to claim that the district court erred in failing to grant you one. And two, there was no misconduct because the jury saw for themselves her demeanor at trial. So in order for it to be misconduct, it has to have misled or unduly influenced the jury. It couldn't have when it could perceive her demeanor itself. As for excessive sentence, frankly, I think the crime speaks for itself and justifies her sentence. The court didn't consider any improper factors, and so it could not have abused its discretion. On the ineffective assistance of counsel, 3 out of 4 of her claims are without merit based on the record as argued in my brief. There's one, the failure to call an expert medical witness that I don't think the record's sufficient for us. Are there no further questions? Yes, you from the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
He has 3 minutes, 19.
3 minutes and 19 seconds, Mr. Grossman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple points with regard to this. I believe it's important, again, for the court to understand, which I'm sure they do, that this is a case involving a child. I believe that, as I mentioned in my argument before,
before that those injuries that had happened before the final injury that actually caused the death of the child, I believe they tend to inflame the jury. And talking about, look at the list, a bruise, a scrape, a bump. Again, they're injuries to a child. They should not have happened. It's much different than the high impact that caused the death of the child. But I believe allowing that in, is highly prejudicial in the case of a death of a child. With regard to the statement by the prosecutor and our argument that it's misconduct, again, the way that it was said, the way that it was referred to by the prosecutor was a perception by the prosecutor, not this is what you saw. And I believe that itself, again, to these kind of cases, can be highly prejudicial.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That takes us to the next case of the day, which is State versus Jack E. Harris. I am recused in this matter. Justice Wright will preside.